The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. This election season, especially the runaway success of Bernie Sanders, has raised questions about whether the United States would or could integrate a more socialist system. For many Americans, stories of paid parental leave, free college education, and health care are just that, stories. That may work in Scandinavia, but not here, at least if we value the freedom that comes with capitalism. Journalist Anu Partanen came to America from Finland, full of respect for American optimism, ingenuity, and social mobility. Instead, she found anxiety, frustration, and exhaustion. Her book, The Nordic Theory of Everything, argues that Nordic policies don't work because, as many Americans believe, Finns, Swedes, and Danes have a natural affinity for each other. They work because they benefit everyone's self-interest. We first read about her theory in The Atlantic, where she wrote the article, What Americans Don't Get About Nordic Countries. And Anu, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
You are now a U.S. citizen living in New York City. When you first came here, what was your understanding of the American dream?
For me, certainly, I had visited the U.S. before I moved here in 2008. I certainly assume that there's this energy and optimism and American dream is that you children might do better than their parents and you know you have your house, you make enough money to have that sort of comfortable middle class existence. But in reality, when I moved here, I really discovered that actually I had no idea what American society is like and how it works and how times have changed and how difficult it can be to reach that American dream that we kind of everywhere, and I think in America too, have taken for granted that Americans are the richest of all, that the American middle class is the wealthiest of all. And that's kind of what I assumed as well coming in. But I discovered that there was much that I didn't know.
When you found yourself anxious, mystified by these elements of everyday life that you were not used to, certainly, like what? And how was that different from how you and other people lived in Finland?
So, for example, American healthcare is just baffling. I think people, you kind of have an idea that, oh, I've heard that Americans maybe pay, you know, a lot for their healthcare. But to me, it was so surprising. For example, I just had not understood at all when I started hearing Americans talk about that jobs that come with benefits or whether it comes or not with benefits. And in Finland, job benefits are, you know, lunch vouchers or maybe your employer supports you going to the gym. And I didn't really understand what the big deal was. And it really took me a long time to try to figure out how American health insurance works and what does it have to do with employers. Then, of course, I don't have children yet, but following my friends and family around, I started to, you know, hear all these snippets of all this education stuff, like that how they were looking for into schools and comparing preschools and sending out applications and comparing prices. And all to me was also baffling because in Finland, people don't really do that. They, of course, might talk about their children's schools, but it's very different. Most children go to public school that's next door and you don't pay for education.
Well, your essays in the book focus on four key relationships: parents and children, men and women, employers and employees, government and citizens. And what I found running through them is, in America, we have this notion of independence. You know, everybody is making their lives for themselves. But you observe in several of these essays and in several of these cases, utter dependency. Like what?
When I first came here, you kind of assume that Americans are very free. They move freely from one city to the next. The whole idea of America is that you're very free to be who you want to be and make your own way independently. So I was a little bit baffled at first when I started looking around. And the first thing I was thinking about were women. And in American popular culture, there's often this search for the perfect husband. And I had always thought that that's just sort of an exaggeration. And when I came here, I started to realize that people really actually have to think about their finances very carefully when they get married and if they want to have children, because that's how American society works. If you have a child, if one of you wants to stay home on parental leave, often the woman, then if your employer doesn't pay for it, obviously most don't, so then one of you has to be earning enough money. Or if you want to stay home, maybe you have to quit your job because you don't have long enough of parental leave. So then again, one person stays and works, and often it's the man. So these kinds of questions that I was not familiar with at all, because in Finland, it is very much assumed that because there's a universal policy of paid parental leaves, that both parents stay home for a while to take care of the kid, your job waits for you while you do this, you get paid, and then you go back to work. So then the assumption is that both parents work, and there isn't any of this calculation like whose salary is going to pay for what and are both going to be able to work. So this was very surprising to me. And this relates to healthcare as well. It was very surprising to me to realize that in the U.S., often the whole family is on one person's health care, which or health insurance, and this insurance comes through that person's employer, which then makes the whole family, in a sense, dependent on that employer and the employer's choices of plans and insurance. And this, too, was kind of shocking to me.
So it sounds like, you know, you're describing what everyone describes as the sort of Nordic paradise, you know, the northern countries paradise that we do not have in the U.S. And there are a lot of reasons that in the past there has not been political will to create those kind of societies. And this is largely based on the tax burden. Now, the tax burden in the U.S. is the lowest of any Western economy. I'm looking at, you know, income tax rates, top marginal income tax rates here for countries like Denmark, 60.4%, Sweden, 56.9%. There's a lot, especially during this election cycle, that we've seen of voters rejecting establishment politics en masse because of the idea of overspending, because of the idea of a nanny state that can tell you what to do or what not to do. So is that just a fundamental difference that cannot be overcome?
Well, I think when we discuss taxes, there's no point discussing taxes unless we discuss what are we getting for our taxes. Of course, nobody wants to pay huge amounts of taxes if you don't get anything in return. And I think this is often lost in the American discussion, partly because right now in the U.S., many middle-class people feel that they don't actually get much for their taxes. So why would you want to pay more for taxes? Whereas in Nordic countries, I think people see it more as I am paying these taxes so that these services are arranged for me. And so this ends up saving everyone money and saving everyone time. And this is one thing that I often encounter in America, that I feel that Americans have sort of, they miss the key point of what the Nordic well-being state, as I like to call it, rather than welfare state, because in American mind, the term welfare state often means that, oh, it's a state where the government gives money to the poor. It takes from the rich, it gives to the poor, and it creates dependency in the poor people, and nobody wants that. Well, I agree, nobody wants that. Now, Nordic people don't want that either. And for example, in my language, in Finnish, the term that we use for welfare state, it doesn't have anything to do with the concept of being on welfare. These are completely different concepts. So I would talk about well-being state. And the idea is that everybody, the middle class, pays for these services. And by these services, I mean the publicly subsidized daycare, universal health care. In the U.S., this is a flat tax. So both people who of less means and people of more means are going to pay about the same for daycare unless the quality is very, very different. Whereas in Nordic countries, if you finance these through progressive income taxes, then obviously everybody, in a sense, pays according to means.
Many Americans have an idea that Nordic countries are some sort of socialist paradise where everybody looks alike and makes just about the same amount of money. Well, they're also not stressed out and anxious, says our guest Anu Partanen. She's a journalist and author of a book called The Nordic Theory of Everything. It's a collection of very even-handed essays looking at and comparing life in five Nordic countries and the United States. Well, American dynamism has been fueled by waves of immigration through the years. And in Nordic countries, there has been increased violence spurred on by racism, anti-immigration movements, especially in Sweden. Finland's government is now proposing income requirements for Finns and foreigners under humanitarian protection who want to live in Finland with non-EU partners. So this idea that yes, you can exist in this kind of egalitarian society. I'm not going to call it a socialist paradise. But does that egalitarian society only work if the society is basically closed?
I don't believe that. I mean, sure, there's challenges. Like, the immigration situation in Europe now is, of course, very difficult. All of a sudden, huge numbers of refugees have come in, and certainly Nordic countries have struggled with integrating them and providing for everyone, and the populist anti-immigration movements have picked up pace in all these countries, as one might say in the US as well with Trump. And I think it poses problems in a sense that, of course, the whole system works because you have to have people who work, they pay taxes, then they get these benefits. Then all of a sudden, if you get a huge numbers of people who come in who haven't been part of the system all along and who need services, certainly that can be like a technical problem. But I don't think it's a problem that means that a Nordic-style model cannot work unless you close borders. I mean, Nordic countries are actually very open countries in a sense that they're more open to free trade than the United States. And I think that's partly because, of course, the free trade, it comes with problems. It comes with loss of jobs. It comes with moving factories abroad. This has happened in Nordic countries as well. But if you have a society where sort of the basic services are provided for everyone, then there's less resistance because people don't just, you know, fall through the safety net and are left with nothing. So in that sense, I think Nordic countries are actually in many ways fairly opened and not closed.
Well, and of course, there's a strong competitive streak in American culture as well, in the American character. And how does that figure in here? You know, business innovation. A capitalist system is trumpeted as becoming a crucible for ingenuity because if somebody can find success, if they can find a great product, if they can sell it to people, they can be wealthy, they can be rich. So how do you compare that to the motivation for an entrepreneur in a Nordic country?
Partly there's truth to that in a sense, of course, that America is a very innovative, great country for entrepreneurs. I mean, that's fantastic. That's one of the things I love about America. But I think that in that case, Americans sort of miss that Nordic countries actually have produced numerous innovations. Finland had for several decades, Nokia was the largest mobile cell phone maker in the world, and it was based in Finland. And Finland is a country of 5 million people, and it produced this company. Sweden has all these companies that Americans by now probably know well. H&M, the clothing store, the Spotify, the music service that everyone uses. Skype was developed by a Swede with Estonian help. Another point I'd like to make is that is often, I think, missed, that for entrepreneurs, for example, having some sort of universal health insurance is great because you start a company, first of all, then you already have health care for yourself. You have health care for your children. If your company fails, and most startups fail, then that doesn't mean that, oh, well, I'm now unemployed and without health insurance for my whole family. So this kind of allows you also to take these risks and be sure that, okay, so at least I'm not immediately destroying my children's, you know, and family's future.
So what do you think, Anu, having lived here for a few years, is the biggest impediment to America as a whole embracing this kind of idea of more Nordic, egalitarian, socially mobile society?
Obviously, you can see that Bernie Sanders supporters, this is a big movement. A lot of people clearly would like to see more Nordic-style social policies and movement towards that. I think the Trump movement is also very unhappy with the state of America now and state of their opportunity and feeling that their life is not going to get better. But they have a little bit of a different approach. What would help? And their approach is maybe stopping free trade or anti-immigration. So what stops America? I think partly things that I've discussed here that I think people maybe have sort of bad experiences or wrong ideas about what it would mean and how it would work and who it would help if we had these policies, like who would pay and who would benefit. I also find it curious that Americans are the most can-do people of the world, anyone that I know. But then when it comes to government, all of a sudden it's like all this can-do spirit is just lost. I see like people have almost you know, eyes glaze over and it's like, no, cannot happen. No, never. Impossible. Government does not work. What happened to that can-do spirit? And these things have worked in the past. You know, there are examples of what American government does very well. You know, people like Medicare, Social Security. Many of these initiatives could be done closer to home. So in states or in cities, it doesn't have to be necessarily starting from federal government. So I really feel like you could do a lot. And maybe it's just this general sort of, we need a little bit of rethinking of what government could do and whom it could benefit and how it all could work.
Well, Anu, you came here for love, which I think is the best reason that one can move anywhere. You're staying?
Yeah, for now at least. I mean, there are so many things I love about America. I'm happy here. But I do think that America makes life unnecessarily difficult for vast majority of Americans. So I think there's always room for improvement, both in Nordic countries and in the United States.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anu Partanen, she's a journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times and The Atlantic, among other places. You'll find a link to more on her book, The Nordic Theory of Everything. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Vexillologists study flags, focusing on their history, category, and usage. But some flag historians go a step further, going out into the world and lobbying for more beautiful flags. Roman Mars from the podcast 99% Invisible looked into a heated flag flap in Portland, Oregon.
Here's a trick. If you want to design a good flag, a kick-ass flag like Chicago's or DC's,
you shouldn't have a seal on a flag.
That rule, for some reason, Americans just can't grasp.
No lettering or seals.
We have tons of flags with writing and municipal seals on them. And that's bad.
A seal is designed to be on a piece of paper, close up. A flag is meant to be seen from a distance on a piece of fabric that's moving. Seals don't belong on flags.
That, my friends, is Ted Kaye.
Ted Kaye, I live here in Portland, Oregon, and I'm involved in the study of flags.
Unlike a lot of his fellow vexillologists, that's a person who studies flags, Ted is especially interested in flag design. Many other vexillologists are more focused on history, protocol, and usage.
There's one school of thought that says we should be dispassionate scholars.
But then there are people in the second group, like Ted, who love beautiful flags and go out in the world and lobby for better ones.
Those who are in the second camp have identified a name for those people, and that's a vexillonaire, an activist vexillologist.
One of the intriguing things about the fact that Ted Kaye and the largest subnational flag organization are both based in Portland is that Portland didn't have an official flag for the first 100 years of its existence.
Portland had several flags that had been proposed and not officially adopted.
But that was about to change in 1969.
A group proposed a flag to the city. The city commissioners wanted realism. They wanted the name of the city on the flag. They wanted a rose. They wanted a mountain.
Jeez.
They wanted lots of stuff on the flag. The arts commissioner said it should be abstract, it shouldn't have words on it, much more consistent with our modern perception of what good flag design is.
The Arts Commission selected an esteemed local artist named Doug Lynch to create a brand new design. It was an abstract design.
Doug's design was I would call it an offset cross. The blue lines that crossed represented the confluence of the Columbia and Willamette Rivers. And then those stripes were bordered by yellow stripes, gold stripes, which represented either commerce or grain flowing along the rivers. And everything was on a background of green, representing the forests.
It's really lovely.
City Council said, thank you for your design, and put the city seal on it.
I know all the graphic designers in the audience are digging half-moon-shaped scars in the meat of their palms upon hearing this violation. It took a few years, but the city council version of the flag made it out into circulation in 1973.
But being a relatively poor design with that city seal on it, most people can't tell it's the city seal even. It's kind of a yellow gold blob. The flag was never widely flown.
So nearly 30 years later, Doug Lynch joined the Portland Flag Association. Doug told them he wished the Portland flag looked the way he had designed it, without the seal.
But it's been 30 years. It's too late now.
And they're like, whoa, 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 whoa. Wait a minute.
Look, Doug, it's not too late. Sitting around the table are the person who's written the history of the flag of the city of Portland, the person who's written the guidebook on flag design, the person who actually manufactures those flags, and you, who designed it. We ought to be able to get this changed.
And with the help of future Portland Mayor Sam Adams, they presented an ordinance to the city council to update the flag.
The council held a vote on the ordinance, 5-0. They adopted the flag, and Mayor Katz said, pointing to the old flag on the flagpole, take that down and put it in archives. Can you put that new flag up?
The correct city of Portland flag. It's handsome. It's a good flag. Best of all, people in Portland actually use it. If you don't see your city flag anywhere in your hometown, maybe it needs a redesign too. But that's just the Vexlin air in me talking.
And that story came to us from Roman Mars and the podcast 99% Invisible.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the fall of 2015, members of a small Muslim population in Wyoming together bought a house in the northeastern town of Gillette, the goal of turning it into a mosque, the third in the state. A group called Stop Islam in Gillette emerged and responded with protests and threats of violence, arousing the interests of the FBI. It is by now a familiar narrative, local groups rejecting foreigners and newcomers. But in this case, the Muslim community is neither. Neither foreign nor new. Many trace their roots back to frontier-era American West and have been considered locals in Gillette for far longer than some of those now openly harassing them. Catherine Schultz won a Pulitzer Prize for her feature on the seismic risk in the Pacific Northwest. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. That's where we read her article, Citizen Khan. It's a profile of Zarif Khan, a successful businessman and patriarch of what is now today nearly 20% of Wyoming's Muslim population. Catherine, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So Zarif Khan, what do we know about his origins and how he made his way from the borderlands of Afghanistan and Pakistan to Wyoming at the beginning of the 20th century?
Well, you started with the hardest question because that is the part of Zarif Khan's life about which we know the least. But we do have some basics. We know that he was born in a little village called Bara, a town of not more than about 75 families in a kind of rural farming area near the Khyber Pass, so in the borderlands, as you said, between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Zarif Khan himself always identified as being from Afghanistan, but in fact, at the time that he was born there, that area was held by what was then British India. Today it's a part of Pakistan. And at some point in his young life, he up and left. We have reason to believe he was probably the youngest son of a family of four or five children. There was not a lot in the way of economic opportunities. The area would have been somewhat politically unstable due to the ever-shifting borders in the region. So there were a lot of reasons to get out of town. Sadly, we don't know his exact ones, his motivations, how he felt, what he wanted, where he was planning to try to get. But we know that in 1909, he boarded a ship in Bombay, and by October of that year, had landed on the west coast of America. I'm sorry, by 1907. And 2 years later, we know for a fact that he had settled in, of all places, Sheridan, Wyoming.
So Wyoming, why do you think?
Boy, it's such a good question. And how do any of us wind up where we are? There's forces that push us out of one place and pull us into another. And then there's just a random chance. Now, for Zarif Khan, as best as we can tell, he probably started out in Seattle, and as became clear, he was in the tamale trade, and that turned out to be kind of a cutthroat business in Seattle around the turn of the 20th century, and it seems like he maybe got out just to have a little bit of a more peaceful environment around him. We have reason to believe he started out in Deadwood, South Dakota after leaving Seattle. Anyone who's at all familiar with history of Deadwood knows that's actually not a very peaceful place. It's got a pretty riotous reputation. So he got out of there as well, tried out some various small towns in South Dakota and Wyoming before settling in Sheridan. Now, most likely that's because the railroad went through there. So like a lot of immigrants, he was probably just following the simplest lines of transit, and he just stuck to it until he found a place that that felt like home.
Well, I have to go back to the tamale thing, because this is his business. He starts by selling tamales, which you explain an extremely popular food around the turn of the century in America, and that there was a network of Afghan tamale vendors in the American West. What, who knew?
Well, not me, I can tell you that. This was one of the many truly startling developments in reporting this piece. You know, I went into it thinking, I have found just the strangest, rarest story imaginable. I found this guy who, you know, came from the Khyber Pass and settled in Wyoming, two places that are absolutely not associated with tamales in the popular imagination. Nonetheless, this guy winds up turning that into his business and, in fact, his career. So it seemed like a one-off, and it seemed strange and interesting, and his family members all kind of had these sort of just-so stories about how it happened. Oh, maybe he started in Mexico, maybe he was taught to cook by a Latino immigrant somewhere on the West Coast. But no, as you're saying, it turns out, as is often the case, truth is stranger than fiction. He did not go to Mexico. He was part of a tamale craze. At the Chicago World's Fair in 1893, an enterprising California businessman introduced the tamale as sort of faddish new foods of the time, and it just took off like wildfire. I note in the article it was kind of the cronut, or the miniature cupcake, if you will, of the era, and suddenly everyone was eating them, and I mean literally, you know, talking about them, writing songs about them. There were like big dance numbers and jazz and blues songs about them. There were a couple movies about tamale vendors. So it became a really popular street food, and people started selling it all across the country. As is often the case, because you don't need a whole lot of money to start a business like this, it's very appealing to newcomers, to immigrants, to the poor, and different regions of the country, different communities started kind of taking the lead in this trade. And sure enough, in the Rocky Mountain West, as far as I can tell, a huge proportion of these vendors were men from the Afghanistan-Pakistan regions.
Khan was well established by 1925 as Tamale Louie, when community members from his town vouched for him to become a U.S. citizen. 5 months after getting his citizenship, a U.S. attorney filed suit to revoke it. On what grounds?
Yeah, this is another one of the really interesting developments for me in reporting this case. As it happens, the life of Zarif Khan intersected with American immigration history in this really fascinating way. At the time, in the 1920s, not only was the U.S. prohibiting people from really almost any Asian nation from becoming U.S. citizens, they were actively stripping those who had somehow slipped by and already become citizens of that status. That process is called denaturalization, and it sprang from a kind of series of cultural and political events. The country had established something called the Asiatic Barred Zone, which established a region of the world encompassing what is today probably 40-some countries, I mean dozens of countries whose native citizens could not be naturalized, they could not become American. A whole series of related laws that essentially tried to protect American citizenship as a kind of prize only given originally, basically, to people of white European ancestry, later after the Civil War, extended to people of African ancestry as well. But in Khan's early life in America, it was really very difficult for Asians to become citizens, and anti-Asian sentiment ran very, very high. Now, Khan himself was, by all accounts, very beloved in Sheridan and seems to have sailed through the naturalization hearings. In fact, there were literally front-page articles kind of celebrating his new status as American. So locally, among those who knew him, he seemed like the very stuff of citizenship. I mean, the embodiment of the American dream, someone who came from afar, penniless, started his own business, kind of climbed the ranks, did the bootstrap thing, was generous and beloved by his neighbors and friends, truly made himself an American. But none of that mattered in the eyes of the federal government. And in fact, if you dig through these archival court files, you come up with United States of America v. Zarif Khan, this 1926 lawsuit in which the federal government tried and succeeded in stripping him of his citizenship.
I'm speaking with Catherine Schultz. She's staff writer for The New Yorker, and we're hearing an immigrant story about a man named Zarif Khan, who left the Khyber Pass region and settled in Wyoming, becoming a beloved and successful member of the community. Now, more than 100 years later, a small but vocal anti-Muslim group has emerged in the area and is threatening their safety. Well, despite losing his citizenship, he did begin quietly building his fortune. Now, this is a man who could not read or write. How did he do it?
Well, through two avenues. One was the obvious one, which was this incredibly successful little restaurant he was running. He started out just as a street peddler, eventually got a pushcart, and then eventually rented out a little restaurant. By all accounts, an absolute hole in the wall. I don't want to say dive because it was apparently scrupulously clean and a pleasant place to be, but really just this tiny little joint. But 60 years on, everyone in Sheridan over the age of 50 or so remembers it vividly and I think had countless meals a month there. In an obvious way, he was making his money by selling the most popular food in town. But far less obviously to everyone who knew him, it turned out that at least since the early 1920s, Zarif Khan had been playing the stock market. As you said, he did not know how to read or write, but everyone who ever interacted with him said he was a very, very smart man, a very quick study, very good with numbers, very savvy. He always had a young kid, a high school kid, or a couple of them working for him. And every day he would have one of these kids read him the business pages of the Wall Street Journal or whatever local newspaper they were getting or both. And he began investing. There are a lot of rumors that circulate about the life of Zarif Khan, some of them unsubstantiable. One of them is that he made $1 million before the stock market crashed in 1929. Now, that would have been a huge sum of money at the time, so I take it with a grain of salt. Certainly anything he earned then was wiped out, as with most of the country's savings in the stock market crash. But almost immediately afterward, he began to rebuild, and he was very smart. He bought up stocks that had been made very affordable by the crash. He still had the restaurant to anchor him, and times were tight, but little by little, he began buying up these very major stocks and just sat on them decade over decade over decade until at the end of his life, he had what would be in today's terms at least $3 million, and that was just in the United States. By a lot of accounts, he had another $3 or $4 million back in his homeland of Pakistan.
And he did go back and forth to Pakistan several times. He did ultimately get his U.S. citizenship in 1954, as we read in your article. And on one of those trips back from Pakistan, brought home a 15-year-old bride and living very modestly from the outside.
Very much so. No one had any idea that he'd made so much money, including his wife and children. Now, they lived comfortably in many respects. It was a small, modest house, as you say, but sufficient for everyone's needs. His children were certainly raised not in luxury, but in comfort. He had six children, and as I said, not even his wife had any idea of the amount of money he had. The only real clue was that he was famously generous, and that was true both in the United States and in Pakistan. Back in his hometown, he was helping relatives buy the land that they worked, so they weren't effectively just sharecroppers. He was helping them buy houses to live in. He was building mosques and wells so that travelers would have places to get fresh, clean water and to pray. And here in the United States, he was supporting, by some accounts, basically everyone in the community one way or another. So he showed his financial resources that way, but otherwise lived a very modest life. And it was only after his quite tragic death that the word broke that he had been a very wealthy man.
Yeah, he was killed in Pakistan by a relative. It's a terribly sad, tragic end to a man who sounds like just, I don't know if I can say mensch about it, but it sounded like a real mensch. But his wife did, his family and wife did return to Wyoming, where she became a business tycoon in her own right, got the family into the hospitality business that they are still in today. Of course, the family expanded, more moved over from Pakistan. Now roughly 200 Khans living in Wyoming, pretty well integrated into the community, as you write, and shocked when this anti-mosque group began to campaign against them. Now, was it just an anti-mosque group, or was it the presence of Muslims at all?
Broadly speaking, it was the presence of Muslims. And I want to say on behalf of the town of Gillette and the state of Wyoming more generally, most people, certainly those who knew the Khans, but well beyond them, were somewhere on the range between extremely supportive and utterly neutral as to the opening of the mosque and more generally to the presence of Muslims in town. But this group that sprang up, Stop Islam in Gillette, the mosque was the precipitating factor, but this was an organization that truly regarded all of Islam as a crisis within the borders, and not just Islam, I think more broadly, regarded foreigners and certainly foreigners from the Middle East as a true threat to everything from the culture of Wyoming to national security. So in addition, for instance, to trying to shut down this mosque, this was a group that was actively opposing the resettling of any Syrian refugees in the state of Wyoming, which was a little bit of a fool's errand in that Wyoming is literally the one state in the union that doesn't have a refugee resettlement program. So there wasn't a lot to fight against on that front. But sure, this was a group that I think as much as anything was just fueled by xenophobia, by fear of the unknown, and in the case of the mosque, a real ignorance about the people that had started it and their incredibly long history, you know, century plus history in the actually very young state of Wyoming.
Well, this guy that you spoke to is the founder of Stop Islam in Gillette, Brett Colvin, seemed very frank with you in his language. He wanted to, at least he says this on his podcast, run the ragheads out of town, believes that they're planning to invade America. So not, as you say, representative of much of the population of Gillette. But how is the Khan family reacting to this?
You know, as you might imagine, with dismay and shock and fear in measured proportion, I think they recognize as much as anyone else that this is not the majority sentiment. But of course, they're really shocked. And as much as Brett Colvin and Stop Islam in Gillette is, I think, not representative of the Khan's overall experiences in the state, it's certainly representative of a really troubling moment in our national political culture. You know, one of the things Brett Colvin said, and I bring it up in the article when we were speaking, he mentions that his great-grandfather, I'll misquote him slightly, but essentially that his great-grandfather used to be paid $5 a head for slaughtering Native Americans for the U.S. cavalry. Now, I don't want to go so far as to say that Colvin said this with tremendous pride. He was actually fairly neutral on it. I don't know whether he disavows that history or lays claim to that history, but it was striking to me because in that sense, he and Zarif Khan are, they're both representative of very longstanding strands in the American character. And one is we all came here from somewhere. We all made a home here. We all found a way here. And the other is this equally kind of robust and persistent strand of hatred and fear of the other, of very deliberate and often state-sanctioned violence, of a kind of constant effort to, quote, preserve America for, I think, a kind of fake nostalgia of what America really is and who Americans really are. So it was quite striking to me to find these two characters mingling in this one little town in Wyoming.
A fascinating and eye-opening story, Catherine. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're so welcome.
Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Catherine Schulte. She's staff writer at The New Yorker. You can find a link to read her article, wonderfully named Citizen Khan. Link is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. All immigrants coming to this country face uncertainty, where to settle or how to make a living. The one thing they can usually rely on is an embassy or a consulate, a little piece of their home country on U.S. soil. But Lukman Barwahi comes from an ethnic homeland with no defined borders and no diplomatic nerve center. So he's created his own informal embassy in the northern suburbs of L.A., a place aimed at keeping his people connected and his culture alive, which is not always easy. Producer Taylor Haney brings us the story.
At Nuroj Kurdish Cuisine, people leave their chairs and get up to dance. The musicians have been playing for hours. There are pastoral paintings hanging from the walls. The dancers link arms, forming a line that snakes through the tables. An And on those tables, chickpea soup with semolina lamb dumplings, served on copper trays. For dessert, fried goat cheese drizzled with honey.
This is more of a cultural center or more of an embassy for me to display a Kurdish culture.
If the restaurant's an embassy, Lukman Barwari is the ambassador. The Kurdish people don't have a real embassy because there is no Kurdistan. Kurds are spread through corners of Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. The people and their culture have endured war after war. For some, that means coping with displacement.
Here we feel like we're not fully rooted in the system, or in the culture, or in the soil, because we were not born here.
But he's been here in the U.S. since the 70s. His family fled genocide in Iraq. He ended up in Los Angeles and made a long career in biotech, and he was good at it. But 2 years ago, he left his career and opened his restaurant. He still has family in Iraq, some of them fighting ISIS in the Kurdish army. Even now, decades later, as he hosts parties at Nowruz 12,000 miles away, his connections to his homeland can pull him away at any moment.
2 days ago, my cousin got killed by ISIS. Actually, I found out on Facebook he was fighting the ISIS forces. And my heart sunk when I saw his picture. I couldn't believe it. How do you celebrate where people are still being killed or fallen and become martyrs?
News like that might have drawn Barwari back to see his family. But he's tried, and he found there was no going home again.
This 30 years of departure, it has created a void. I noticed that after going back to Kurdistan in 2001, that my childhood memories were all shattered.
Barwari was staying with his uncle in Iraq. They went to his childhood village and started looking for his old home.
The village that I grew up with, the village was divided into two parts by a beautiful river. And when I went back, there was no home, no trees, no sign of any buildings. The river was almost dry. It was not recognizable anymore. That was my first time going back there and never went back.
You said that your childhood memories were shattered. Mm-hmm. So how do you pick up those pieces and make something new again?
Opening a place like this, listening to the Kurdish music, introducing my culture, my music to people is way of maintaining my culture. And the memories stay alive.
Those memories can be painful, but he says they motivate him to have a restaurant like this, a place where Kurds can celebrate their culture.
Deep inside ISIS, who are these people?
Victory celebrations in Kobani.
Barwari threw a party when Kurdish forces freed a Syrian town called Kobani from ISIS.
I thought we'll just be overwhelmed and people would be have to standing out or sitting outside. Mm-hmm. We prepared for that.
But the restaurant was maybe three quarters full, and the energy in the room was low. Because elsewhere in America, people were watching TV.
2:02 to play in Super Bowl 49.
Barwari was obviously disturbed.
If you're a patriot, you care about your nation and freedom, then how do you equate that with the Super Bowl, right? I'm really disappointed at those people that did not turn out by just staying home and watching football.
We're staying aggressive!
Okay, so let's roll here, okay? Just like we always do.
This is what Lukman Barwari is facing. He's trying to bring together the Kurds of Los Angeles. He wants to maintain his culture. But fading memories of the past and regular reminders of those still suffering make American life seem comfortable. Still, Lukman says, it's not home.
We don't know where we really belong. We're all in the air.
And that story came to us from producer Taylor Haney. By this time tomorrow, we will know whether or not the United Kingdom voted to Brexit the European Union. Meanwhile, politics here in the U.S. went full British parliamentary raucous yesterday. Here is House Speaker Paul Ryan at 10 o'clock Wednesday evening trying to bring the House back into session as Democrats staged a sit-in to force a vote on gun control.
but the chair would hope that the business of the House could be conducted in a fashion that respects positively on the dignity and the decorum of this institution to which we all belong.
That video was broadcast by MSNBC, but much of the protest was streamed by House members themselves on YouTube and Periscope. We can only imagine how many congressional interns had to teach them how it works. Cheerio. Word of Mouth is making its exit for today. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is NHPR.